Hello and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly podcast where we discuss some topical leadership issues. This week we're focusing on events up to the 19th of October 2018. My name's Nick Scott and I'm an economist and academic working with the Institute of Leadership and Management, and I'm joined today by the Institute's Head of Research, Policy and Standards, Kate Cooper. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Nick.
Monday the 15th of October marked the first anniversary of the hashtag MeToo movement, which encouraged social media users to adopt the hashtag as a means of drawing attention to personal stories of sexual harassment and assault. Employment law firm GQ Littler has found that businesses have implemented rules that range from the sensible, for example, where those who have influence or decision-making power over another's career are held to a higher standard of what's appropriate in the workplace, through to the very specific, such as male and female employees should not share rental cars when away together on business trips. Can rules prevent unwelcome sexual behaviour?
Well, what immediately strikes me as about one of these rules is that the male and female employees, which is ignoring that there are other sorts of sexual orientation. I think what is very important, though, is a recognition that firms have a safeguarding responsibility to keep their employees safe from, as we get with health and safety, from accidents at work that affect their or could impact their physical health. We are aware increasingly, especially with last week being Mental Health Awareness Week, that work can be a contributor to more poor mental health. And what firms are saying here is that we're also trying to protect our employees from predatory sexual behaviour.
We know that many people meet their future partners at work. Will this sort of regulation mean that the workplace will no longer offer that potential?
We've actually done some research in this area a couple of years ago, and we were invited to speak about it on BBC World News. You cannot stop people falling in love, and policies and guidelines will not do that. It will continue to happen. The only consequence will be increased secrecy. But we're not really talking about romance here. We're actually talking about an abuse of power. And that can express itself or can manifest itself in unwanted sexual advances, but it extends throughout the organisation and throughout the supply chain. If one is in a more powerful position than another, one is able to take advantage of that. And that is about not treating people with the appropriate levels of respect. So where we have a culture that we respect everybody, there will be a very different climate and much less likely for these incidents to happen.
That may be the case, Kate, but what should businesses do as and when these guidelines are contravened?
Zero tolerance is something that often comes to mind as an appropriate response. We won't have these situations and we refuse to countenance them. These things are great things to say, but it's how you act when a situation arises, because of course it will. People will misunderstand, or they will flout, or they will call it political correctness gone mad. So it's how we respond to these by taking appropriate disciplinary action that really evidences a zero tolerance.
Our second news item takes us in a completely different direction. According to Quartz at Work, silent meetings are becoming all the rage. For some time now, meetings of Jeff Bezos' team of senior executives at Amazon have begun with participants quietly absorbing up to 6 pages of the written word, which can lead to silences for as long as 30 minutes before the meeting proper starts. Do you think this approach could catch on?
How often have we been at meetings when somebody is ill-prepared, but that doesn't stop them commenting, and then we have to have explanations? As some of the critique of this has been about how much time it adds to the meeting. But in actual fact, my view is that it could really make the meetings quicker, because you're focused, you're prepared, and you're able to progress the items on the agenda much more swiftly.
Some might say, fine, that works for me. But would it suit all participants and in all scenarios?
Many people like to formulate their ideas as they're articulating them. And of course, for people like that, meetings are great. But for others who like to be more reflective, who want to absorb information before arriving at a conclusion or an insight they want to share, this sort of preparation is ideal. So what you're doing, you're still allowing the talkative people to talk, but from a position of understanding and information. And the more reflective people who tend to contribute less are able to have thought their ideas through beforehand. This is, for me, creating a level playing field for meetings and ensuring you get the absolute best out of them.
Inevitably, Kate, there'll be some people who say, why didn't we get all of this information in advance and I could have read it at my leisure and been prepared?
This isn't the sort of activity that will work unless everybody buys into it, so everybody commits to the 30 minutes. Why not give it a try? Why not see if it works? Experience the benefits and the drawbacks and then decide whether or not it's going to become policy.
In our third item this week, a recent academic study cited on SME Web shows that overly optimistic thinking is leading people to set up businesses that have no realistic prospect of financial success, which may partly explain why only 50% of UK business startups survive their first 5 years. Does entrepreneurial activity attract optimists?
Founders often have a brilliant idea for a new product or service, and they are so enthused with the great idea, they forget that actually there needs to be a significant market for it. So this optimism that we're talking about here might actually be an absence of proper market research. Just because you think it's great doesn't necessarily mean that everyone else is, or you might not have the communication strategy in place to tell people about it. So I think there's a disconnect here between that enthusiasm, the drive that makes someone want to go it alone, to found a business, and the realism of actually, does somebody want what it is I'm trying to sell?
SME Bank Aldermore point out that two-thirds of SMEs have no real succession planning strategy in place. However, that wouldn't explain the high early failure rate of startups. What's behind that?
Frequently, problems cited for the failure or lack of ability to grow of SMEs are down to two things. They get the customer wrong, either overestimate demand or poor communications in terms of letting people know. But they also often mismanage the finances. They either grow too quickly with the associated cash flow problems, or their financial management is poor, so they're not getting bills paid on time. They're being chased by creditors, or even perhaps their wages bills not being properly managed. So those functions you can see almost absent apart from that founding zeal. So I can see how that might go well with the optimism we've been talking about earlier, but it's very poor business sense.
Well, finally this week, the Institute of Leadership and Management took a stand at the exciting World of Learning conference at the NEC. Any particular insights come out of that experience, Kate?
We were also lucky to be able to deliver a seminar, and it was packed. We had so many people wanting to hear about the importance of self-awareness as the first step in leadership learning. And we were really enthused to see how many people are taking authentic leadership seriously, taking leadership development seriously, and seeing themselves as the first part of that process.
Thank you, Kate. Sadly, that's all we have time for this week. Please go to the website www.institutelm.com to find out more about the Institute of Leadership and Management. And please subscribe to this podcast series.